Thank you. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're now ready to proceed to the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar. Before we commence with arguments, I will ask first for the marshal to call the case, and then I have just a couple of quick remarks.
Calling A230177, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Larry Ray House Appellant.
All right, and again, good morning. So I'm sure counsel is familiar with how we proceed here. Obviously, today we're doing this by video conference platform, and I just want to remind you that while we have the video up and operating now, what the court does is maintains an audio recording and places that on the court's website. So to make that audio recording more accessible and understandable to everyone, we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then it should be visible to you on the screen that we've got a clock, right? And 15 minutes for each side plus 5 minutes for rebuttal. So just keep your eye on the clock. The conversation goes quickly. We really enjoy getting this opportunity to hear from you. And so with that, I think we're ready to proceed. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Mr. House. Mr. House did not get a fair trial in this case. When an accused person is denied the opportunity to present more than two witnesses to testify that his complainant or accuser has a reputation for dishonesty, and when the accused is not allowed to present evidence that his accuser had a motive to lie and make up a false accusation because the accuser was caught watching pornography, and when the state moves to admit Spriegel evidence at the last minute, 3 days before trial, and when the trial court admits the Spriegel evidence and only gives a limiting instruction at the time of the final jury instructions and not when the accuser is testifying, and when the trial court denies the accused the opportunity to present witnesses that would have testified that they never saw any sexual abuse or sexual behavior between the appellant, Mr. House, and his accuser, then Mr. House was denied a fair trial. Mr. House's right to a fair trial and to present a complete defense and to due process were all denied when he was limited arbitrarily to two witnesses regarding the complainant's reputation for a lack of honesty or truthfulness. The witnesses that were wrongfully excluded were number one, Devron House, the appellant's son, and number two, Renee House, who did actually testify, but she was not allowed to testify about this subject of the complainant's reputation for being untruthful. Why, you ask, was this evidence excluded? The trial court said,
"Counsel, with this, I think that there was actually a request to put in more than just those two that you met, or the four, I guess, the two that were permitted, the two you just mentioned. I think the request, as I recall, was for more witnesses. Is that right or not?"
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Smith. You might be referring to the witnesses that we wanted to present on the question of whether...
I might be wrong, but I guess no matter how many were offered in terms of the reputation for truthfulness, when does a district court abuse its discretion with respect to deciding that it becomes cumulative to have multiple witnesses? Or is it that any witness offered by the defense for this purpose must be permitted to testify if any of them can?
Well, thank you for that question. So, you know, we're not arguing that in a hypothetical case that if a defendant wants to present 11 witnesses, that you have a constitutional right to present 11 witnesses. That's all hypothetical. That's not the case at bar. So that's why we're arguing the facts of this case that, as far as I understand, we wanted to present four witnesses. We were limited to two. What is the magic number about two? You can't just pick a number arbitrarily and say, well, I'm only going to allow you to present two witnesses. What is the basis for that? What's a rational basis, let's just say? Well, the trial court didn't even say that it was cumulative. It didn't say that it was going to make the trial take too long. So if anyone were to hang their hat on that, it would be completely speculative because that's not what the trial court said. So we're only asking for two additional witnesses, one of whom testified anyways. And the person who testified anyway, as I was getting to, was Renee House, the appellant's wife. Since she did testify anyways, then that means that we're talking about a few additional questions in direct examination and a few additional questions in cross-examination. So it would be adding very little to the length of the trial.
If I may just ask a quick question. You are very focused, and it's common to focus on when we talk about whether evidence is cumulative, the amount of time that the evidence might take to present. And I appreciate all of your remarks on that, because I, you know, certainly make a case in that regard. But it seems to me under Rule 403, the district court is presented with a balancing choice in deciding. So there has to be an assessment of the probative value of the evidence and then weighing it. One of the many factors in weighing it is, you know, the cumulative, whether the evidence would be cumulative and therefore becomes needless, I think is the language of the rule. So I think what I'm struggling with in your argument is that it's missing that balance, which is normally why this court, for instance, defers to the district court. So if you could address all of that, you know, obviously truthfulness of a witness is important. I'm not questioning that part. It's how helpful is it, you know, in a balancing way, balancing these factors that are set out in Rule 403, how helpful is it to the jury to decide credibility of a witness just based on more and more witnesses giving evidence as to the general reputation for truthfulness?
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Bradfold. So I looked at Rule 403 this morning. And so it says, although relevant evidence may be excluded if the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of issues, or misleading the jury, or by consideration of undue delay, waste of time, or needless presentation of cumulative evidence. So as we said in our brief, the court has to do a 403 balancing test, but the only problem is, what did the trial court actually say? We could speculate, or people can create after the fact rationalizations for why a trial court did something, but there's a reason that we have transcripts and such. That's the only insight we have into a trial court's mind, is either what they said or what they wrote. And in this case, there is no written order on these questions. So all we have is the answers in the transcript, the trial court statements in the transcript. So all the trial court said is it would be unduly prejudicial to the state. What does that even mean? That there's no evidence that the trial court is doing a balancing test and saying that, oh, it's cumulative, or the jury would go to sleep, or would just take too long. The only evidence in the transcript, Your Honors, is that the trial court said it's unduly prejudicial. Well, it really is not very helpful. So, I mean, I think what it comes down to is basically it was going to hurt the state. That's what unduly prejudicial means. The evidence, as Judge Bradfold kind of sort of mentioned, this evidence about whether the complainant is truthful or not, it's absolutely crucial. It's the entire case. And that's what we pointed out in our brief. This is a case like many of these cases. There's no DNA evidence. There's no physical evidence. There's no contemporaneous reports around the time when the sexual abuse supposedly happened. There's no statements to third parties around that time. And so you have a testimony of a complainant, and you possibly have a testimony of an accused person. And the credibility of the complainant, therefore, in a case like that is paramount. It's everything. So to exclude a couple of additional witnesses who would have testified about the complainant's reputation for untruthfulness is absolutely devastating to the ability of the appellant to put on a defense. So his right to
counsel, if you'd extend that answer just a little bit for me, because it seems to me that, you know, if we agree with you that the district court abused its discretion in excluding the two witnesses that you're raising on appeal, then we would, to grant you relief, we would have to also find that that abuse of discretion was prejudicial and had an effect on the outcome. And so would you address that question?
Sure. Thank you, Judge Bradfold. So, I mean, it's clearly prejudicial to us. That's what we argued in our brief. It's
absolutely. But as to the outcome, that's my question.
Right.
Well, you did get a chance to challenge the truthfulness of the victim.
Right. We had a chance because we put two witnesses up there. Two witnesses is not enough. You're not entitled to present an unlimited number of witnesses, right? But that's not what we're asking for. We're asking for basically one additional witness plus another witness who already testified, but they weren't allowed to testify in this point. That's Mrs. House. So we're asking for a few additional questions from her, basically. So we do think it was highly prejudicial because basically this question of, is the complainant telling the truth when the complainant goes up there and tells the jury this person sexually abused me? That's the whole case. If you don't believe the complainant, if you're the jury, you don't believe the complainant, that's it. Case is over. So it's absolutely prejudicial in our opinion.
So I have a follow-up question to that. What would be the additional testimony that those two other witnesses would have provided regarding ML's reputation for untruthfulness?
Well, thank you, Judge Reyes. So, I mean, there's no way to quantify this, right? You can't say that when Devron House's testimony was excluded, that's worth 5 and Mrs. House's testimony is worth 6. There's no way to quantify it, right? So I can't answer the question in quantitative terms, but they would have testified that they knew him very well. They'd known him for years. They knew his reputation in the community for truthfulness or lack thereof, and that his reputation was that he was a liar. He had a reputation for not being truthful. So that's pretty powerful testimony. Usually in a jury trial, you don't have a situation where there's several people that are going to testify that the complainant has a reputation for being a liar. That's pretty powerful stuff. So to me, the more witnesses that we could put on, and we're only asking for one witness plus a few more questions of someone who already testified, the more that we could put on, the more impactful that is to the jury, because this is an absolutely crucial issue. It's the paramount issue in the case.
How is that testimony different than what the jury had already heard, though, with the two witnesses who did testify as to ML's reputation for untruthfulness?
Well, each person stands on its own. Each person had a different reputation with the complainant, Judge. So I guess that's what I would say. And
right. But if testimony is going to be cumulative, the district court certainly can exercise its discretion to say, we're not going to have 4 witnesses, 5, you know, one more, 10 more, if the testimony is going to be cumulative.
Yeah. The only problem with that, Judge, is that the trial court didn't make an explicit statement that it's going to be cumulative or wasting time. They said it's unduly prejudicial to the state. That just makes it sound like it's hurting the state's case. So if anyone is going to say that it's cumulative, well, that's a post hoc rationalization of something that the trial court did not actually say. With regards to some of our other issues, because we're running short on time here, the trial court wrongfully excluded evidence about the complainant, which may or may not fall within the scope of Rule 412. I don't see how it does fall within the scope of Rule 412 that, say, the defendant, the complainant was caught watching pornography. Therefore, he had an excuse to lie and make up a story that someone else did something to him and get out of the trouble that he was in. I don't think that falls within Rule 412 because it's not prior sexual conduct of the complainant, but even if it does fall within Rule 412, it falls within the constitutional exception that we talked about in our brief, that it is necessary to admit evidence if to exclude it under Rule 412 would violate the defendant's constitutional rights. And so we think that the evidence should have been admitted because it shows a motive to fabricate and it shows a source of sexual knowledge. The state argued that, well, we're not arguing, we're not going to argue to the jury that Mr. House is the source of the complainant's sexual knowledge, but I don't think that really actually cuts it because whether the state is arguing or not, in all of these cases, a jury is going to look at these things and they're going to say, oh, well, he knows about these things because the defendant did something to him, whether the state argues it or not. And so the fact that he was exposed to pornography, there was people masturbating in front of him, he was sexually abused, these all show a source of sexual knowledge. Whether the state was going to argue that the defendant appellant is the source of the knowledge or not, the jury is still thinking about it.
May I ask counsel, I know we're at the end, but the motive to lie, could you just tell me, was it Mr. House who caught the victim watching pornography? I didn't really follow the connection between being caught, as you say, watching pornography and a motive to fabricate a claim against Mr. House.
Mr. House is not the one who caught the complainant, Judge Smith, but thank you for that question. As I understand it, it would be his mother or other relatives. I don't know that that's really clear in the record who it was who observed that, but our position is that he was in trouble because he was caught looking at things that he wasn't supposed to look at. It's irrelevant to our argument about who caught him is not relevant to our argument. And so he was in trouble with his mother and other people. The way to get out of trouble is to say someone did something else to me, but I see that my time has expired.
I just want to follow up myself with one quick question. You can address it in rebuttal if you'd like to, Mr. Keller, you know, whether there's any record here that the victim has any evidence in the record showing that the victim has a history of false accusations. And you don't need to answer now. You can cover that in rebuttal. So with that, I think we have already reset the clock and we are ready, Ms. Scanlon, for you to proceed with the respondent's argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kelsey Scanlon and I'm an assistant Cass County attorney and I am representing the respondent. The trial court was correct in its evidentiary rulings and its denial of the appellant's departure motion. And I'm respectfully requesting that this court affirm. Just to first address some of the issues that came up during Mr. Keller's time, Judge Smith, to address your question, the evidence becomes cumulative when there's several people that are saying the exact same thing. That same thing is they know the victim, they know their reputation. The reputation is that they're a liar and that they would not believe anything that the victim would say under oath. And the defendant wanted, or appellant wanted to have four people, he was limited to two. And what's interesting about that also is that initially the district court indicated which witnesses were going to be permitted to testify. Then upon the appellant's request, the court modified those people. It's interesting because those two, the substitution of witnesses actually incredibly strengthened appellant's case because those two witnesses are blood relatives of the victim. They are purportedly have a stronger connection with him and know him much better than the other two witnesses that the district court initially permitted appellant to call as witnesses. Judge Brevold, referring to what you asked defense counsel, I think that the court inferred the basis as the cumulative effect. That to me is what the analysis was that the district court weighed when determining whether to admit this evidence.
But counsel, we, as you mentioned, we have to infer that because the district court never explicitly said that the testimony would be cumulative. To the contrary, the district court used other language as noted by Mr. Keller. So how can we rely on the rationale that it would be cumulative when the district court never said that?
Thank you for that. So while I agree, I also do think it is important that this is for people that essentially we're going to say exactly the same thing. And each witness, going back to another question that was asked, each of them had the strength on their own. That was what defense counsel said. They each had their own independent strengths, but the weight of what they said was most impactful from the two that were chosen because they were the blood relatives of the victim. And while you are correct, Your Honor, that the district court did not use the cumulative effect analysis, I think it does make sense by simply cutting the amount of witnesses in half that that's what the intent was. And the court can limit the number of witnesses that are examined when it would have a cumulative effect. And there's no governing rule or case law that restricts the number of witnesses that can testify about the reputation for untruthfulness to a specific number, but it is unreasonable and it's prejudicial for several witnesses to provide repetitive testimony that they're a known liar, that the victim is, and they can't have any direct evidence about the crime. The district court's ruling was correct because it limited the amount to a reasonable amount of people, and that balanced the interest of the parties. And again, while the court indicated that it would be unduly prejudicial, I think that the fact that it's cutting them in half does take into consideration the cumulative effect. So he was allowed this opportunity to essentially discredit the victim. And as defense counsel indicated, the credibility of the victim is what is completely accurate here, or completely the most important part of evidence here. And in this case, despite what damaging testimony that there was about the victim being a liar and that his own aunt and uncle would not even believe anything he would say, wasn't persuasive to the jury. And I think that's important to consider as well, that the two most, the people with the biggest connection to him, that the appellant himself with his defense counsel chose to essentially discredit him, were not enough. So I think that the weight of the evidence that the other two witnesses would have provided was much, much less just due to the familial connection. The court also did a balancing test when it referred to the state's motion for Sprigel evidence with respect to the appellant's victims in the 80s, and the court completely excluded that testimony. It permitted the Sprigel testimony on the victim and the appellant themselves, but it completely excluded that. And so this court had a lot of evidence to consider, a lot of, to determine, and made the right decision. And so for all those reasons, the trial court was correct in its evidentiary rulings, and it was correct in denying the defendant's or appellant's departure motion, and I'm asking that this court to affirm.
Are there any questions from the panel? Okay. All right, thank you very much, counsel. And what we'll do is reset the clock for you, Mr. Keller. And there'll be 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. So Judge Bratfold was asking me to address this about any claim of previous false accusations of sexual assault. We're not claiming that there were. We were never arguing that. There is no evidence in the record of that. With respect to Spriegel evidence, if the state wanted to introduce this evidence of other crimes that Mr. House supposedly committed against his accuser, the state should have charged those as a separate counts. Instead, the defendant appellant is left in a Hobbesian choice, basically, because there's things that the complainant said to the police that he didn't say to the jury, and perhaps a vice versa. And the state points out in its brief that the defense had plenty of notice of this Spriegel evidence because it was in an amended complaint that had been filed a year before the trial, which is all true, except that begs the question then of why wasn't the Spriegel evidence motioned back then instead of 3 days before the beginning of the trial, resulting in a process where neither side had an opportunity to brief the issue. And so now we have this evidence that was admitted. Various cases like Ness and Kennedy make it clear that when the state asked to admit Spriegel evidence, and they say the reasons it's admissible are X, Y, and Z, the trial court isn't supposed to just take that for granted. They're supposed to really examine it and see if those are really legitimate reasons to admit the Spriegel evidence. So unfortunately, in this case, what happened is what we see in many cases where the state either literally or figuratively checks off every single box. So they check off a box that says proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, absence of mistake or accident, even though maybe none of those things are actually applicable to the case. So there was no dispute here about motive. So that's not a reason to admit the evidence. There's no dispute about opportunity because without the Spriegel evidence, everyone knows that Mr. House and the complainant spent time alone. There's no dispute about intent because he never argued that he did it by accident. Preparation, I don't think is relevant, but we get down to the one issue here where the state has argued that it might be relevant, but clearly an absence of mistake or accident, that doesn't apply. He never said it was a mistake or an accident. Now, the state has argued that this is basically admissible as some type of modus operandi or common scheme or plan. That's really not correct because there is no singularity to the type of acts. One claim is that something happened in the hunting stand or went out hunting. Another claim is that something happened in the house. And so there's no common MO or method or modus operandi between those type of things. And then the state tries to turn it around and say, well, but it shows that he was doing different things to get him alone, but there's no question that they spent time alone. So it's not relevant for that reason. That's not a reason that applies. It's not applicable. So the truth of the matter is, not only was the Spriegel evidence motioned in an untimely fashion and the parties never got to brief it, but all the state's proffered reasons are all irrelevant. None of them apply to this case. Now, since my time is running out, I also want to point out that the appellant wanted to present seven witnesses who all would have been short to say that they never saw anything improper between appellant and complainant. And the appellant was not allowed to present any of those, even though it's clear that there were allegations that things happened in the house when other people were there. So based on all these evidentiary rulings, we would argue that even if they were not prejudicial or grounds for reversal in and of themselves in an isolated basis, one by one, that they are grounds for reversal when taken as a whole. They were prejudicial, and therefore appellant's rights were violated and he should be accorded a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. Again, we very much appreciate hearing from you. It helps us in our decision-making. So with that, this matter is submitted to a court for this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.